Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with fascinating people who have different perspectives and different life experiences from me. And then we get to talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. And I include you in that comment because every time you reach out to me through my website, narrativeofplace.com, I get such a thrill about hearing what you're thinking about. This week at our podcast table, we get to talk with Catherine Ricketts. She is an essayist and songwriter. Her nonfiction focuses on the arts, grief, joy, and spirituality. If you are fortunate enough to be a friend of hers, you experience the way she crafts beautiful and sacred space in her home. And then she invites people in to experience God in profound ways. One of the many things I enjoy in Kat's writing is her interest in physical beauty and place. She absorbs some inspiration from Wendell Berry, who is a fantastic writer about the necessity of people's connection to place. Not just necessity, but he reflects on how deeply place can reach into a human and profoundly influence them. Before we get to the richness in Kat's writings, I asked if she would explain a little bit about her place, at least the early place, maybe of her childhood. And when she looks back as an adult, does it feel like that place influenced her in how she thought about God or formed her very early views of who God is?
I lived in the same town for the first 18 years of my life in the Princeton area in New Jersey. And the town that I grew up in was quaint, affluent, well-manicured, and safe. I grew up within walking distance of my elementary school. My life as a childhood was relatively simple, and I think it fostered in me a deep sense of security. And because I was also growing up in a small town Presbyterian church and my family was very involved there, in a deep soul kind of way, I think I associated God with safety or protection. And I'm grateful for that. I'll also say that the place that I grew up was very homogeneous. It was a very white, affluent town, and my family and I were part of the dominant culture there. And I'm sure that shaped my understanding of God in some ways that shifted in a really beautiful way when later I moved away from a homogeneous town into a very diverse city. So in retrospect, I just recognize the ways that my understanding of who God is and God's love for people has shifted since moving to an urban environment.
So are you referring to your move to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you have a pretty dramatic shift in context. And so your perceptions about God changed with that context?
Yeah. So I went to college in Philadelphia and have spent the better part of my adult life oriented around the city of Philadelphia, whether living in it or working in it or worshiping in it, even in seasons when I lived just outside of the city. And Philadelphia is the sixth most populous city in the United States. It is a majority-minority city, so the majority of the people that live there are non-white. And economically, it's very diverse. And because of how populous it is, I just interact with people that are very different from me every day, both on the street and in the places where I worked when I was working in Philadelphia. And I think that has just really expanded my understanding of the bigness of God's love. I think it's easy when you live in a place where everyone is similar to you to believe that God's love could be only for a certain group of people. And I say that noting that for millennia, people have lived only among people that are like them. So I don't want to inherently dismiss that as a positive way of living your life. But I do think that living in a more diverse place just opens my mind to the bigness of God's love, the bigness of God's mercy. And I have to believe that God moves toward and loves even those whose expression of faith is different from mine.
You are a writer. You're actually an artist, and your artistic skills come out in many different ways. But your writing in particular, which I would include songwriting in that, when did your interest in the word smithing, when did that really start to bubble up as what would take you down a career path?
Yeah, my interest in writing began early. I remember as a kindergartner or first grader being lauded for a poem that I wrote. And I think that having my parents and teachers recognize that in me early on just reinforced an interest in it. And then I was always interested in English classes because I felt like literature was a way, unlike in my other classes, to have really meaningful conversations with my classmates. Literature always seemed like a way into questions of the heart, interpersonal relationships, and the things that I at that time found most interesting. So I went on to study creative writing in college and to do a master's in creative writing after that.
So I was really drawn to something that you wrote. Artists can help us see beyond the surface of our community, to rightly imagine its wounds and to hope for its healing. We need to encourage them in the creative process, dignifying their profession by paying for their work and rallying around their performances. Artists use bits of the world in order to change the world in light of a new vision of the world. Artists help us to see. I love that. It's so good. I'd love to hear more about that from you and what you think that looks like in our neighborhoods. What is that fleshed out and lived out? What does that become?
For me, the way that I have sought to live out that sentiment is through my work in arts institutions. I love giving opportunities to artists, whether that is commissioning new work or planning events that connect artists with audiences. I have done a lot of that in my career, and I just really believe in the artist's role in a society because they address the imagination. And I think it's Jamie Smith who says that the imagination is a privileged channel into the heart of a person, that it bypasses the intellect and just cuts straight to the heart. And I have given the better part of my career to giving artists institutional support to be able to make work that helps us to see the world. And then in my own practice as a writer, it really matters what I attend to, because what I see in the world is what I'm going to show people in my writing. And so, for instance, right now, I've moved outside of Philadelphia and I live in a suburb, and I'm not exposed to the kind of diversity of experience that I was exposed to every day. And so I have to find other ways to see that. If I'm not seeing it every day on my walk to work and in my interactions with colleagues who come from really diverse backgrounds, how am I exposing my eyes and my imagination to a holistic picture of the world so that I can communicate that in my writing in a way that does justice to the world as it is? And then I also really try to cultivate habits of simplicity and silence so that small details become big to me. I think if I'm really busy, then I'm just seeing everything in kind of broad brush strokes. But if I'm living slowly, then I can notice my son's eyelashes and I can notice the the little bit of green that has just come up from the lily bulbs that I planted last weekend. And I think those details are really important in the artistic imagination, the artistic vision, and what we give to our readers or our viewers or our listeners.
Now, I've been pondering this for a while. When I stop and I think about this last year, I actually notice that there's a theme of imagination that keeps coming up for me. It's not the theme I was expecting, but I realized it's always been there. I hear it when I talk to my guests on this podcast. I feel the need for it when I'm crafting new articles to publish. I'm obsessed with it when I write courses. We are in the season of Pentecost in the church. Well, the Catholic and the Protestants all celebrated last week, and the Orthodox will in a couple weeks. I see in the book of Acts this unbalancing process of people realizing that God's imagination has always been bigger than our own. Think about that first Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. God communicating to a whole variety of people in the language that most made sense to them. And then God pushing all the boundaries that made people comfortable by pulling in a diverse group of people with various backgrounds into the church. So, imagination. Are we bold enough to embrace God's imagination? I don't know, but it is stimulating to think about. And one of the reasons why I love having artists around me is because they show me where my boxes are simply too small. And they show me where I'm not seeing a holistic picture of the world, you know, that Kat was talking about earlier. And I wonder if developing an artistic eye can actually help us develop hope that the wounds of the world can really be healed.
Yeah, beauty, aesthetic beauty is something that gives me a lot of hope. I'm just really cheered by things like my son's eyelashes and the bulbs that are coming up. And I listened to the podcast with the writer of The Spirituality of Wine. And I love the way that she talks about celebration and the sacraments and how we need these tactile, visual, edible, drinkable things in our lives to help us understand God. So I think these aesthetic details are really important to me in believing that life, while full of unexpected loss, can also surprise us with its beauty, and that can make the loss bearable.
You have a piece that you let me read, which was wonderful. It's called Silence. It's written about the time that you lived in St. Michael's. I'd love for you to describe that place for us. Like, what is St. Michael's? What's the rhythm of it? And how did that affect you?
St. Michael's is a town in rural Maryland on the eastern shore of Maryland. And it's a town that is surrounded by the Chesapeake Bay. Coming into the town and driving out of the town, you see farmlands. And sometimes behind the farmlands, you see the water. It is a very quiet place in many senses of the word. It has a very small population. I think that it was like 1,000 people that lived in the town of St. Michael's. So quiet in the sense of there's not a lot going on. And then quiet just sonically. There's a lot of wind and a lot of, not a lot of human sounds. So my ears were open there to things like wind and birds in a way that they were not in Philadelphia. Being surrounded by the bay, there is water, but it doesn't have the energy and the tumult of the ocean. And so there are these, visually, these big expanses that are just flat going out into the horizon, and they're still. So yeah, as a place, it is flat, still, silent.
There's this part in your essay, and as soon as I read it, I was like, oh, I've had this experience. You just put it in a much more beautiful way, I think, than I've ever explained it. Do you mind reading that paragraph?
When we were preparing to move here from Philadelphia, I expected that peace would be the natural effect of all this open space. I expected that the patter of my heart would slow, the chatter of my mind would quiet. I wish I could tell you that this was so, but sometimes my mind rages more loudly here in all of the silence than it did in the city's clamor.
Yeah. Do you think being in that space with all of the silence, did it affect your writing and your artistry and how you processed emotion and interpersonal relationships?
Yes, definitely. I moved there hoping that I would get into a master's program in creative writing and that being there would be a time to really focus on craft. My life in Philadelphia was beautifully full of relationships and obligations, and I wasn't really getting any creative work done. I think I will always have, as I said about those high school English classes, I will always have just this love of other people's presence and story and just being in the company of others and having meaningful conversations about the things that are most dear to us. But writing in large part is a solitary practice. So moving to St. Michael's, we had a few close friends through our workplace. And I moved there. I moved there with my husband of 9 months. So we were newly married. And also my father had just died. So the month after we were married, my dad died of brain tumor. And so moving to St. Michael's, I think I needed a place to recover from the intensity of caregiving through my father's illness, paired with the intensity of falling in love and getting married and integrating this new person into my life. And I knew that writing would be a way through that, and that in order to write, I would probably need some quiet. Yeah,
yeah.
That's what I'll say about that.
But then, I mean, because I had this, I was coming out of a really crazy few years in my life, and I went to this place where the physical beauty is astoundingly amazing. New Zealand. It was the northern part of the South Island of New Zealand. And I went kind of going, I'm just going to soak it in, just kind of take in the quiet, different rhythm. And I realized that although that was all true and the beauty was super helpful, I brought my mind, my emotions, my problems and issues with me. It was all still there. And so in reading your paragraph, when you say, but sometimes my mind rages more loudly here in all the silence than it did in the city's clamor, I was like, that's exactly, I remember that surprising me when that happened, because I was expecting quiet outside to be quiet inside, and that wasn't necessarily the case.
It's as if the empty space outside creates this cavern that your thoughts can then expand into, whereas there's not really that space when you're busy and surrounded by so much stimulation in an urban environment. And while I was living there, this really unexpected loss came upon my family. My brother, who had been struggling with addiction for over a decade, in a moment that was very surprising to me, died of a heroin overdose, an overdose of heroin and fentanyl. And I think that especially is when the raging of my mind really, really began. I had so many, I spoke about my upbringing, cultivating this sense of safety and of God's protection in me. And this was the thing that caused me to realize that the world is not safe, that the thing you most fear might actually happen and could happen again at any minute. And I was at that time working for a a faith-based organization and had had some experiences there of colleagues being let go for theological differences with the organization. And because of that, I couldn't quite really honestly articulate the questions that I had for God, because I didn't feel totally safe to ask the questions because they might lead me to a place of what some would deem as unorthodox. And so I think in the quiet, there was this kind of turmoil within me that the process of writing ended up being the safe container in which to explore.
It strikes me you've had these two very profound experiences with a father dying and a brother dying that is so challenging and so hard. And you've written about both of them. Do you think they came with different theological questions? It being your father that comes with a sickness that is, I mean, a brain tumor that people can point to and identify and work towards. And then a brother where it was a lot more unexpected. And also an addiction, a sickness, but not put in the same kind of medical category. Mm-hmm. So as you've processed through the grief, those two different types of grief, did you end up with two very different kinds of experiences about who God is and what questions you needed to be asking and processing with God?
My father's death felt sacred to me. He was 68 when he was diagnosed, 70 when he died. He had lived a very dynamic, virtuous, beautiful life. And he was a Presbyterian minister as his later in life career, who believed really wholeheartedly in the resurrection, and who said repeatedly throughout his illness, "I just have this sense that God is holding me cupped in his hands." And so the experience of losing my dad was like just releasing him deeper into that safe palm. There were not, maybe I'm remembering this poorly, but I don't feel like I had theological questions that really lingered with me after my dad's death. I missed him. I spent a lot of time eulogizing him, just remembering and writing and celebrating and doing all the things that we do to remember a life and then to absorb the reality of the death into our new realities. My brother spent most of his adolescence and adult life as an atheist. And we had some conversations in the weeks before he died about how he was kind of more agnostic than atheist, that nihilism was no longer convincing to him. So there was kind of a softening and curiosity later in his life, but he did not profess faith in any God, let alone a Christian God, during his lifetime. So that led me to really difficult questions about if a person doesn't want to live their life with God and has chosen out of their own will to live a life apart from God, will God mercifully receive that person into eternal life? Does Joe want that? And I mean, the negative answer to that question is just horrifying. And when it's an actual person who you have lived your entire life in family relationship with, it is no longer an abstraction or a pamphlet. What I realized is that it was a matter of my brother's company with me. As an addict, he was a hard person to get close to because he needed to hide the things that were getting him through his life from the people that were closest to him. And so I spent a lot of time trying to move toward him, and he spent a lot of time trying to move away from me. And maybe one of my deepest desires in my life is that I would have communion with him, was that I would have the kind of kinship that a sibling relationship ought to have. And the thought of losing that for eternity was unthinkable to me. And so I needed to do a lot of work in my own heart and in my brain to identify what did I believe about this. I think a lot of us carry around unexamined theologies of salvation, and I needed to examine it, but I needed to do that in a place where it wouldn't put my job on the line, where I didn't have too much input from my very broad and dynamic community of spiritual friends. So I did it in writing, and I did it with my writing mentor is also an Episcopal priest who has great book recommendations and offered some spiritual guidance, probably in the guidance of the writing. And then I did it with a spiritual director and a couple of close friends, but really needed to pull away. And this is another reason why being in St. Michael's was in some ways positive, to pull away from this vast network of relationships and obligations in Philadelphia and to really reckon with God by myself about what I believed.
This conversation is somber, and yet there's something really beautiful in it, a little bit like we're stepping out onto sacred territory. Please join me next week when Catherine Ricketts sits once more at this podcast table. This episode is only possible because of my Patreon team. Support, ideas, and encouragement from people like Natalie and Doug McGee and the Sion family are what make this podcast sustainable and commercial-free for all of you. If you want to be a part of the Patreon team, you will find a link in the episode notes of this show. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created all of the good sounds that you hear. I look forward to our conversation next week with Catherine Ricketts. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.